Morning, everybody. Some of you have heard our speaker speak before because he's given a couple of seminars and lecture, so he won't need an introduction to you. But those who have not met Rahul Gandhi before, or Ramchandra Gandhi, I hope I can call him a friend of mine.
Yes, of course.
He is the... he must be very bored of me having to say this, everybody having to say it, but his immediate genealogy is of great relevance to this talk, because he's the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. And I have to say, Rama, that most of us have a perception of Mahatma Gandhi which was due to a film being made about him, and for all its limitations, it did a lot of good, but it also probably fogged quite a few issues in Mahatma Gandhi's life. Anyway, Rama himself, I am going to say to you, is the most important living philosopher in India. He's not in India at the moment, he's sitting with us now. And I hope he'll excuse me if I call him that, because that's exactly what I believe. I was very fortunate to be at a conference in Delhi with him, and I have never heard anybody perform dialectic in the highest possible sense that I could define it than Ramachandra Gandhi. He may not be performing dialectic on this occasion, but no. He will be introducing, unless somebody asks him some very pointed questions, he will be introducing us to the work and life of Mahatma Gandhi, and I think we should be very grateful that we have him here to do that.
Well, thank you, Keith, very much for this introduction. It would be impossible to live up to that, so I won't try.
Okay. I might have to slip out before you.
Yes, of course, yes, I appreciate it. Would you mind if I spoke sitting down? There's going to be a recording of it. We are a small group, and it would be so much better if we were informal. Thank you, Stephen. But never mind that introduction. It gives me great pleasure to be here with you and with the Temenos Academy. It really is rather wonderful that it enjoys this academy, and its vision enjoys the support of His Royal Highness. And this is the sort of thing that should be supported and made flourish. Keith and Kathleen and their wonderful team are doing their best to start something in this country, and in fact in the modern world, which is greatly needed. But I realize that my audience this morning are young architects, and I must confess my complete ignorance of the subject of architecture. And I've worried and thought about it the last few days, and it occurred to me that I might, therefore, talk about architecture. Philosophers are entitled to talk about precisely what they don't know at all. This is an ancient license, so you'll have to suffer this experiment. Now, let me draw for you a sort of map of our world, as it should be. A sort of architectural map, a map of what might be called a home. I imagine architecture has something to do with the making of homes, and not merely of houses and structures, but where we are aware and where alone we can be comfortable and truly at home. I would imagine that would pass as one kind of definition of architecture, a sort of search for structures and places where we can be at home. And such a place is already there. We need to reveal it in our work, I imagine. And what is that world? Now, what I'm about to say will have points of contact with many traditions, sacred and other. But let me say it. It's a map, Keith, which I frequently now think of to explain not only Gandhi's thought and life, but the thought and life of many saints and sages of the world, and good men and women of all ages and all lands. It helps me enormously to see my existence in the following way, and I would like to share this with you, and I hope it might, the map that I'm about to draw in words, will be of some help to you in your architectural work at its deep levels. I think of a vast circle without a circumference first, which I tend to identify with the sky, the vastness of the sky. Oh, by the way, let me say in parentheses that what I like most about buildings is that they have windows and ventilators. I think that's almost essential for architecture. A torture chamber or a tomb can be a structure of great importance. A tomb is a sacred structure. A torture chamber, precisely the opposite. But neither is architecture, I would like to suggest, because they could do without windows. But even a prison cell which has a little window promises some hope of escape for the prisoner, doesn't it? And that is architecture. So I would almost say that windows define architecture. Doors, yes, you get, of course, yes. But windows, especially for those who are in a room. When I look at the sky, I feel that the wonderful thing about architecture is that it provides windows which connect the finite with the infinite straight away. So the first link is with the infinite, wherever we are. If we are in a home of any kind, a house, a whatever, a city, culture has its windows too, which connect us with infinity. The great arts of any culture, the great arts are sacred precisely because they connect us with the infinite. But of course, not without any loss of the intimacy of a place. A tiny hut could also have a window. And a culture very small in size could also have these wonderful entries into the infinite and the vast. So I think of that first vast circle as there isn't a blackboard of some kind here, is there? Doesn't matter. Doesn't really matter. These things are best imagined, really. A vast circle without a circumference. Now, that, I think, any sense of home, private, public, human, civilizational, cultural, religious, whatever, it must have access to the infinite, to the vast. And we don't have to put a name to it. We don't have to call it religion. But the infinite, that which is the great mystery of existence. Everyone has access to this. I was talking to a biologist the other day, and I said, well, I don't know. Perhaps looking at the sky has had evolutionary advantages. It's taught us astronomy and so on. But the eye naturally seeks the sky and a vast space. It's a great mystery. But a child does it, and all creatures do it, and human beings do it, and all cultures do it. So that vast, let us honor it. I would say that in the architecture of existence, we must first respect this vast space. If anyone who's not been taught, any child who's born in a home, and if the children are not taught through songs, through words, through language, through funny stories, a sense of the infinite and the vast, all of these things could later become abstruse theologies and philosophies. But if in some immediate way a sense of the vast isn't taught to a child, even in a slum or in a palace, it's worthless. They're never going to understand the gift of that hut or of that palace or of that city or of that age. Our age, I'm afraid, in some respects, is remarkably without instruction in the infinite. You don't get that sense at all, watching television, for instance, or reading newspapers. You're immediately drawn to utter details of despair or pleasure, whatever. But the sense of, I would love there to be one completely blank page in every newspaper, I think. It would be rather wonderful. It might be a waste of money, but it might be a small investment in understanding the infinite. In any case, it would be without these other horrifying details. But a newspaper is so full of tininess. I say this with sadness because I come from a family of newspaper people, so this makes me particularly sad. But where was I? Yes, some sense of the vast. In the science and art of homemaking, in the deepest sense, and I imagine architecture is that, if there isn't that infinite. And Gandhi was greatly concerned with that. He called it truth. He used to say, quote, for a long time I said, God is truth. Now I want to say, truth is God, end of quote. And by truth he simply meant that which is, that which is real, and which is manifested in the daily responsibility of speaking the truth, and not telling lies. I mean, not necessarily in some profound sense of explaining what truth is, although if somebody is inclined to do that, they shouldn't be discouraged from doing that. But of not telling a lie. Oh, well, I think there's probably room here for a kind of healthy departure from veracity, which you find in India. Sometimes, if you're climbing a mountain in India, and you've lost your way, and you ask somebody who's walking back from there, how far is that particular temple? Oh, he's just round the corner. And that's not a lie. That's a kind of encouragement. I wouldn't want to punish them for telling a lie. But I think it's a way of saying, oh, it's round the corner, and you'll be there soon enough. So that kind of a playful, a helpful departure from the truth is, I think, to be allowed for. But barring that, I think the daily lying about simple facts and about bigger facts, about history, about geography, about the potentialities of human beings for good and evil. We tell a lie when we say that it's impossible to be a saint. We tell a lie when we say it's impossible to be the devil. We can be both. Surely human beings are capable of both. That's a lie. Now Gandhi thought that speaking the truth and indeed to try and speak the whole truth and so on is very important. And this vast infinite sky was the foundation of speaking the truth. That we mustn't pollute this sky with lying. Today, if the atmosphere is polluted, if the atmosphere is a wonderful image of this vast space, is it not? It is because of lying. If industrialization at the expense of the quality of life is happening, it's because a lie has been told that this is in our interest. It's a lie. Basically, it's a lie that's been spread. So truth is that vast circle. And the great mystics, the great sages, I don't mean here the proponents of given religious or philosophical systems, but I mean those who have found something which is even deeper than that, which cannot be named even, but which is pure, and which is like truth, which is very pure. So that vast circle, and this must be made available to every child, every student of science or the arts or anything, every school of architecture or medicine or philosophy, some sense, a deliberate effort made to extend our understanding of truth, of the sacred, beyond what we know from our own nature, including, of course, but some introduction of the knowledge of the sacred and of the infinite from other cultures, and also through the greatest poetry of these traditions, which really is beyond all formulations, beyond all theologies. And that is very, very important. So that is the vast circle. In our home, that is the vast outdoors, which we can never exhaust, but which we can see from anywhere, from the humblest construction. Then I would draw a smaller circle within this vast circumference. A smaller circle, but very vast indeed. Limitless, if not infinite. This is the circle of nature. Of that which has been called matter, lifeless matter. It isn't real. It has its own life. But all the elements which make up the universe, which are the subject matter of study, of science, physical science, but also of spiritual science, nature, within this vast, wider circle of the infinite, a somewhat smaller circle of existence, nature, that which appears not to be living, but it's there, set a foundation. I see nature not as living, but so profoundly modest in the way in which the materials of your work are stones and slabs. There is a modesty to them. They don't compete with us for food in the same way. I see here almost a divine humility,
the disorder of reality, it is not competing with us for food. Imagine what the state of the world would be like if everything, at all, everything, were to be fed and supported and clothed. There's a nakedness. There's a wonderful poverty, like that of a monk or a nun, which you find in matter. Now, physics doesn't quite see matter in that way, does it? But I think we could, surely. And this is something so sacred, what we walk on, in its undemandingness, in its purity, in its simplicity. But that's the other field, utterly sacred, that which we can touch, that which we can hear, that which we can smell. Nature. Now, there's a very great poem in the sacred literature of the Hindus, and I'll tell you the gist of it. But you will find such poetry in all. That which we stand on is seen by this sage, who is the transmitter of this poem, as he says, addressing the earth. He sees the earth as the divine mother, mountain breasted. He says, it's the mountains, ocean clad. It's a rough translation. You are so beautiful, my mother. Forgive me, I have to walk on you. He apologizes to the earth for this. He honors her. But that is the other side of nature. If we were to see the vast, the outer circle as infinite, as limitless, as manifested in theologies but never exhausted by them, if we could see nature as profoundly modest, profoundly humble, sacred, to be honored, would we explore the religious finesse in relation to the wider circle, all that other exploitation of matter which has been going on, that we grab what we can from it, all the energies of it we want for ourselves. Basically, this springs from the life that it is emerged. That it's just there, something which we can do what we like with, forgetting that we walk on it with its permission. The earth doesn't quake all the time. This is why we survive. It has, of course, occasionally. The native peoples of America think that the earth really rests on a turtle, and when the turtle moves, the earth moves. But this turtle is a sacred being. So if we have that map where the circle of nature is the circle of the sacred, of the humble, of the modest, then we would also be humble and modest in relation to it, wouldn't we? So that is the other circle that I would wish to draw. Steve, can I? Oh, there is some water. Wonderful. I get very thirsty. It's an Indian habit. It's just association. At this time of the year in Delhi, one would be drinking water all the time. So I tend to do that, even when I'm probably not actually thirsty. So there is that other in our home. In the architecture of our existence, there is that other. And Gandhi was very clear about this too. Like this transmitter of the sacred poem that I've just described to you. He was very clear that we were meant to be in our search for knowledge and control of nature, both, to be quite modest. That there is that. You might be shocked by what I'm about to say. I hope you will not be. I find philosophers you will forgive me, are meant to be outrageous in their remarks, and I hope I will be suitably outrageous. I find that the desire for endless knowledge is a bad thing. If you love somebody, you don't want to find out everything about them, do you? If you fall in love with somebody, and you say, "Well, now tell me what you were doing on Tuesday, 1945," you don't want to ask anything like that. You don't love them if you ask that kind of question to extract every last bit of mystery and knowledge of. You don't do that. So if you love nature, you wouldn't really want to find out all that there is to it. Soon enough, the beloved, nature, or a man or woman, will share with you all their secrets at the right time, in the right way, in the right quantity. You mustn't insist on too much too soon. There's a simple principle of love. Everybody knows. But when it comes to applying this to nature, we forget it. And we think we have a right to discover every law of nature
and convert that knowledge to technological use, and then to military use, and then to and so on, to in the service of hatred. I think it is a big lie that endless knowledge is our birthright. It is not. No more than endless knowledge of our beloved is our birthright. It is not. So I would say that's also founded on a lie. That the endless exploitation of the energies of nature. No. And Gandhi was very clear about this. That this is not the way to happiness. He was convinced about it. That is his legacy for our world. We must revise, utterly revise our conception of our home, of where we can be at home. We cannot be at home where the vast circle is dominated by narrow theologies, competing, warring theologies. But only when the vast circle has room for all theologies and much, much, much more. And we cannot be at home in a world where the less than the very vast circle of nature is dominated by greed, human greed for knowledge and for control. No, we cannot be at home. We are all colonizers of nature. This is ridiculous. All humanity can be that. Imperialists we are in relation to nature. Tyrants we are in relation to the other circle, which is so sensitive, which is something that we are meant to learn from. So this vast circle, this inner circle, this inner court, the vast court and the inner court. Court is such a beautiful word, courtyard. There's so many beautiful places in the city which bear that name. So that is that inner court of nature we must respect as something whose secrets and whose powers will be shared with us, but only when we exercise respect and moderation. We must revise the ideology of science for that, if necessary. We must ask the physicists to tell us more about the physicist sometimes, and less about nature. We know very little about Einstein. We know a great deal about nature, which Einstein saw. I wish we knew more about Einstein. Now, Einstein has written about himself, but not as a physicist. Do you follow what I'm trying to say? As a physicist, his curiosity was about something other than himself. I think we are the poorer for that. Science may maybe richer for that. Right, so I'm still on the subject of architecture, eccentrically defined though it is by me. Okay. So you have a circle within this circle. Who will tell me what that might be? Who will, with sympathy for your lecture, tell me what, predict what I might want to call the court within this, the smaller, the still smaller, but quite far. Surely life, living beings, tiniest microbes, human beings, and all other life in the universe. Now that is something so distinct. If modesty and even insentience were the disguises of God in nature, in matter, but in animal life and plant life and in microbiological life, teeming life, what do we find? I think what we find is a kind of sport, a kind of energy, a kind of restraint. We find play is the playground, absolutely. It is the giving and the receiving and the taking of life within restraint. I'm told that it very rarely is the case that non-human living beings, they kill beyond the necessity of survival. Of course, their hunting for life is violent and frenzied, but it has its own beauty. It has its own passion. It's never without restraint. And our ancestral Aboriginal human beings, before they hunted, before they killed, they prayed to the species that they were going to hunt a member of. They honored it, and then with their permission, but this is violated. The self-restraint of life is sacred, is divine. You might say that this this quality of self-restraint is there in the vast space, nothingness outside too. We could easily be overwhelmed by it. That which is only a tiny bit in that which is not, which is the vast circle. But it permits this. It's restrained. It's like the earth is restrained in its shakings and in its quakings. Life in its devouring of one is, we don't learn from that. Gandhi was very clear about that we had to learn from that and not just think we were lords and masters of these realms. Gandhi was very hard on those who thought they were lords and masters of the sacred realm, the custodians of religions. He said, you are not. No religious tradition is perfect. There is truth in all, but none is perfect. None can claim the right to think that they have the final and the complete answers. He also, of course, thought that those who thought there was nothing sacred at all were blind, or even worse. But that's another matter. Likewise, nature and teeming life. We must revise the opinion that that's only raw material, food for humanity. It's unworthy of human life, of our exercise in homemaking, in that sacred architecture in which all of us are engaged, to think that that's just stored for us. We've inherited this food for us. What our divine father and mother can't be like that. It's there for us to play with. There is a zoo here, yes. But all of life on earth and maybe throughout the universe is there, I think, to teach humanity self-restraint. We who have other advantages, apparently, of thought and reason and so on, must learn from this innate, inherent self-restraint of passionate life. And we are not honoring this. Sometimes I feel that philosophers are also given to wild speculations. There's an ancient license that they have to this. It's only meant to provoke thought, not to produce theories immediately. But I have a theory. You know, the distinction between a philosopher like myself and a prophet like Martin Luther King is that while he said, I have a dream, I have a dream, I keep saying, I have a theory, I have a theory. It's infinitely worse. Huh? But alas, philosophers only have theories. And I find myself saying, I have a theory, I have a theory, all the time. I wish I could genuinely one day say, I have a dream, that I have a theory right there. That many of these strange diseases, dreadful diseases that have afflicted humanity are there because we really not honored this realm of life. I think there must be subtle messages that we know very little about the brain and about our capacity to send subtle messages. We do know, don't we, from our own experience of life, that if you're in a room, if you're in a pub, say, where there are strangers, each with their own sense of private enjoyment, and if you have hostile thoughts about somebody, they know. They usually know. And you know if they have hostile thoughts about you. And because everybody thinks that this might be the happening, everybody has hostile thoughts about everybody else. And you can be sure of a fight on Saturday night as a result, wherever you are. But that's how human beings are. In our relationship to life, we've been treating life with such great contempt that it's organized its own terrorist squad. That's what these viruses might be. Yes, for its own protection and for ours, for our instruction. It's possible. Now, I wish I could translate this into some kind of mathematical formula and become respectable immediately. I can't. This is just a thought. This is just a myth. This is just a theory. But we can believe it to be true. It must be true. I have not yet seen a wasteful, unecological animal. I have not. No. There may be some. They too would probably learn from us. It's quite possible. Who knows if I may produce another theory? What we've been doing to the tiny atom, it might produce an angry response of some kind of explosion. It's quite possible. I don't think it's any use saying, oh, Ramchandra Gaur, you're thinking animistic thoughts. We've gone beyond that. I don't think so. I think it's perfectly possible that nature and life might be filled with anger in the way in which angry people in a pub are sometimes when they think you're thinking hostile thoughts about them. It's quite possible that the virus today and tomorrow, it might be some strange failure of natural law itself. It might sound crazy today, but who knows? Things might not work in accordance with what we think is natural law because we have not prayed with that young Hindu of thousands of years ago. We have not treated nature with the respect that it deserves. We have not honored the realm of life with the Aboriginal people who learn from its self-restraint. Right. Now, what might be the next circle of our home? Yes? What do you think might be consistent with this diagram? Human life. Surely. Human life. The human species. I mean simply the presence of humanity on Earth. Unorganized, but the species. Now this is very important to keep in mind. Clearly this is not enough. If we don't connect our idea of our species with all life and its sacredness, with all nature and its humility, and with the nothingness, which is also God, which is also the self, and its vastness and infinity, we don't really achieve anything like a proper, respectable definition of ourselves. And yet, at least this, we must have a sense of all of us being a species of life on this planet. Not necessarily one culture, not necessarily one civilization, not even something which is meant to be converted into one culture, one religion, one civilization. That's a great fallacy of our times. To convert all of humanity into some one thing, one kind of society, industrial society, or whatever, socialist society, or capitalist society, or religious society, or whatever. No one blueprint for all of humanity. We mustn't think that it's very tempting to think that all of humanity is raw material for transformation into one kind of human society. No, I think the human species, the notion of a human species is wider and I think more beautiful than the notion of a society. Would you say so? I find increasingly the thought of the species as such, as having a more beautiful abstract shape than a society. A society can, after all, be described more or less easily. But a species existing as such, without all being herded together into one form, is a more abstract pattern which I like. And I wish we could respect that and not impose our patterns of society, our ideas of what the ideal society is meant to be like. Gandhi was quite clear about this. No uniformity. Of course, he's very clear on fundamental principles. Let there be variety. But we must honor our togetherness as the human species. And when we meet somebody, I found this just the other day. I was wearing very Indian clothes the other day. I've got some funny stares, but I was very appreciative of looks also. I look odd, I look weird, but I look all right. My younger brother is very worried. He said, Ramu, you look like a gypsy. We've got a bag. And they think you're running off with something. I said, but I'm walking very slowly. He said, no, but you think you're an expert gypsy. Very nice. But I remained quite unharmed. And I harmed no one. So variety, oddity, eccentricity. It's a great country, this, for honouring eccentrics. In fact, sometimes I think the useful way of regarding Gandhi is as a sort of Victorian crank who made it big. Really. He was here in this city in the 19th century, a student of law, and he was a member of vegetarian societies and anti-vivisection societies. But unlike some of these societies, he didn't only think that the purpose of life was to meet on Friday afternoons to discuss these things and to say how bad the rest of the world was. No. But to get out of this, and to apply these ideas to the major problems of existence and society. So he's really an eccentric, which this city and this country has honoured. And so I'm grateful for that. So, variety of the human species. We must oppose a certain kind of social idealism, really. I'm being heretical. It's no use spending all this money to bring a philosopher from India to here if you don't encourage him to be heretical. I don't think that all types of social idealism, including Gandhian idealism, must be viewed with a certain amount of healthy skepticism. No one formula for everybody, but something to be learned from all of these formulas. So when one system collapses of idealism, we shouldn't be shocked in the way we sometimes pretend that we are. We should welcome these changes. And we mustn't think that some other system is ready to take its place. Marxism has collapsed, so the market economy must go everywhere. I think there are traditional economies that do wonderfully well, that are sustainable. But they can't be imposed on the rest of the world either. There must be a very, very creative, healthy mix of different types of idealism. And all this is possible only if those circles are honored of sacredness everywhere, in all societies. Then, of course, within this now narrowing circles, this circle of human species, is what you might call human society. And there again, there must be variety. We mustn't think that every human society is meant to be exactly like every other. And thank God that this is not the case. The healthy variety of human society is to be respected. And within that, human culture, human civilization, traditions, the variety of these things. No one monolithic thing called human civilization. There are civilizations. They're all opposed to barbarisms. Some see more clearly one kind of barbarism, another kind. All types of barbarism. In India, we saw very clearly the barbarism involved in treating nature and life badly, but we didn't always see the barbarism involved in treating humanity badly. Other cultures have seen that more clearly. So we need to learn from one another. So a variety of, but civilizations as opposed to barbarisms, and they are as various as civilizations. The evil is as ingenious as good. There's no doubt about it. It is very various, isn't it? Doesn't make it interesting. It makes it even more troublesome, I think, to deal with a variety of different kinds of wickedness. And then, within that, the human state. Now, the state, Gandhi had a certain way of relating these things. Each circle had to be a trustee, a guardian. If the human species, this more abstract shape of the reality of human life, is not a trustee of human society and guardian, if it does not utter warning signals, if individuals everywhere, in other words, don't warn individuals everywhere about the wrongs that occur in their societies. That's what I mean by the human species being a guardian of human societies. It is the right of every human being to take an interest in every human society and to warn against its perils. Gandhi warned Britain of many of the perils that lay. And this was an example of the human species being a guardian, being a trustee, being a custodian of human society. Likewise, human societies, social living, simple rules of humanity, must guide us when received habits are not doing their duty, when cultures and religions are fighting with one another, forgetting and the simple rules of humanity. Then they must be told this can't be done. So they become trustees. But in the reverse direction also, human societies, cultures, must warn individuals to everywhere. There is an aimlessness to individual life everywhere. Every human community that is warm and intimate and restrained and modest, and adventurous, and connected with the infinite, has the duty today to warn helpless, aimless individuals that this is not the way to happen. No. You must find companionship. I think Einstein, whom I may have been slightly disrespectful towards a few minutes ago, said something very beautiful to a young man who sought his advice. Einstein was very lonely, very helpless, very aimless. Einstein said, make friends with a human being. And if you can't do that, make friends with an animal. It's wonderful advice to give, I think. All societies, must perform this duty towards individuals, I think, must receive homes in that sense. Societies, cultures, traditions must, at this time of extreme crisis, for individuals all over the world, there are the homeless, one reads in the newspapers, but there are the homeless who also have homes. There is a homelessness which of the bad kind. I think we must remind all individuals. So there is a trusteeship in both directions. Then the state. The state is becoming all-powerful now in so many parts of the world. But I think the state is also a trustee. It has a duty to protect traditions and individuals, but it must also be protected. There's a kind of anarchism around these days. Let's get rid of the state altogether. It hasn't worked. And it only provokes the state into greater tyranny. So there has to be a mutual custodianship, a mutual guardianship of these circles. But right at the heart of this is what? That surely is each one of us. The center of these various concentric circles is each one of us, each individual. But if each individual is the center of this, and I think this must be told through some kind of textbooks, every child must be given a map like this with its own place at the center. Every child. Everyone is at infinite centers to this. But once we see this, our self-image as people would change. Who are the other in this house that that God has made, that we have received, that who is the householder? Each individual. Each person. But each person then becomes a trustee, a custodian of this entire household, becomes the king and the queen, and the prince and the princess of this entire universe. Now I think, is it not for something like this that almost every child in India is called a prince or a princess, given name called Raja or Rani, king or a queen, Rajkumar, Rajkumari. Rather wonderful. The notion of being a prince or queen or a king is a wonderful notion, but it is the description of everyone. Why? Because each one of us is at the heart of this home. We are going to look after this home. But only then this home will look after us in that way of symbiosis. There's so much for architecture from somebody who has no right to speak on the subject. When we talk about Gandhi, you might say, it's about time to, because your lecture is about Gandhi. Huh? Why are we talking about Gandhi? More directly. Although this is his, believe me, essential teaching, I think. That we must be guardians of that which is worthwhile in one another. A kind of fostering of one another. But Gandhi is very important. He is, that may be more historical, more particular, about more concrete. I do really think that Gandhi is one of the best friends that this country could have had during the century. There's a very, in this context, an interesting contrast between Hitler and Gandhi in relation to your country, to Britain. Hitler, probably your worst enemy. You really want to destroy this land. Let it be. Now Gandhi was opposed to the British Empire, but he wanted to help, deeply help the British Empire. And the British people. And this island, not only because he studied here and he received education, not only that. But out of, I think, the saintliness of his heart and the wisdom which comes with saintliness. But a few years ago, I first came to this country many years ago as a student. But when I was revisiting a few years ago, I visited Oxford. I spoke to a friend on the telephone, and she said, "Oh, have you seen the Gandhi mural in St. Mary's Church, the oldest church in the university?" I said, "Gandhi's mural in the church? It didn't exist 20 years ago, 25 years ago." She said, "No, it did exist, but we have installed it there, some of us, and won't you look at it and tell us what you think of it?" So I went along, and I asked the porter at the gate, and he said, "Oh yes, walk 20 steps down and turn left. You know, in that way which comes so naturally to the British, they tell you how to get somewhere without taking you there yourself, which is just as well, I think." Huh? Unlike some others who actually insist on taking you there and insist on running your life for you. But he directed me, and there it was, this Gandhi mural on the ceiling in one corner of the church. He was in that cross-legged position, seated in that Indian style, wearing John Lennon glasses, and with his arms raised like that. He looked more like a gargoyle, and surely you're architects, you know. But it's a gargoyle, not outside, but inside a church. It's very strange. Gargoyles are meant to ward off evil spirits, for church, be it temple, mosque, whatever. But now gargoyles are needed both outside and inside, because there is danger not only from outside, but also from inside, in all society. So it's rather wonderful. The Gandhi is installed, more or less as a gargoyle figure, in St. Mary's Church, inside. I think it's a brilliant piece of architecture, that, if you ask. There he is. Why is he raising his arms like that? And there are several interpretations. One is this, that with one arm, he's sort of voting. With one arm, he's saying, well, there is truth in Christianity, say. With the other arm, he's saying there is truth outside Christianity also. Now, his is the protest against the view that there is no truth in a given. But no, I don't think so. I think those are arms raised to warn and not to cause us to despair. So why is it that people have honoured Gandhi in this country? Some people. I think because some people have seen quite clearly that he was a real friend. And who is a real friend? A real friend is somebody who tells me not only that I'm right when I'm right, but that I'm wrong when I'm wrong. Who's not afraid of losing my friendship, but of deepening it. So when Gandhi returned to India from South Africa in 1915, in South Africa, he had struggled against racial prejudice against Indian settlers. But when he came to India and studied the nature of the British Raj there, he found an implicit racism in British rule. The whole idea of a democratic people, like the British, controlling the destinies of another set of races, another set of civilizations, from a variety of countries, was immoral. And he had the honesty and the strength of friendship to tell the British that. He was a friend of this country. And he did this for moral reasons. Not really that, it is our right to throw you out because this is Ireland. Not only that, but this is not right. This is not worthy of humanity to do this. And he was a friend of India too, because the social inequity of Indian society, he railed against that as vigorously as he did against British peoples. And also religious intolerance. He was a great critic, so he was a friend of the religious traditions of India, of Indian people, and of this country. But he became very unpopular with all three. Religious fanaticism killed him. British imperialism imprisoned him. And society cast him out. So. But he was a friend of all three. And I think this service that he did to Britain is what makes him an ally. Made him, I think, imagine, you were born much, much after the Second War, so you don't know. But the fight against Hitler was really a fight against racism of the most virulent kind, vicious. And didn't have to do this, had to engage in this fight at this appointment, which he had to do this all alone. I think the struggle against Britain, which Gandhi had launched, a moral, non-violent struggle, must have in some way empowered Britain to do this. Must have strengthened her resolve to defeat racism. I think it's a tremendous service that he did. Because surely, during the 40s, when Hitler had waged his war, Gandhi had waged his moral, non-violent war
against imperialism also, and against religious intolerance and so on. So I think you had two kinds of, if you like, difficult people. You had the difficult person called Hitler, and you had a difficult person called Gandhi. He troubled everyone's conscience, but Hitler threatened everyone's peace and society. So that's Gandhi. Now, if you ask me, what is his contribution to our world? He has been he died in 48, halfway through the century. What about the rest of the century? Then I'll go back to that map, because those problems remain with us. Indian society has its problems. British society has its problems. But the problems of the world today have to do with violation. We are violating these circles, these realms of the sacred. Here again, a formula of his helps, although we mustn't become idolatrous of any formula. He said virtually, whatever be your truth, and I'm not trying to summarize Gandhi's teaching, I'm trying to say what it all comes down to. What is this real message of Gandhi? I think it comes down to this. His teaching is this. Whatever your truth, religious, economic, political, medical, whatever, add non-violence to it and don't worry what happens to the formulation. If you are a capitalist, say, alright, fine. Add non-violence to it. Don't ruin people. Don't cause unemployment. Don't cause human beings to be so utterly dependent on factories and on machines and on the human need to multiply wants. Because you're doing violence to them when you do that. When you artificially create unemployment, when you make people forget and lose their traditional skills and crafts, you do violence. Don't do this and remain a capitalist that you want to do. Let capitalism take the risk of doing without violence. Let communism take this risk. What create an equal society, but don't violate individual freedom. If you create a robots out of human beings, well, that's not equality. If you rob them of religious sensibility, then what happens when they become free? They don't know how to handle the question of religious intolerance. They don't know. They've not been schooled in this state. So what's happening in Yugoslavia is partly in Russia, is partly because there is no tradition of handling religious diversity. No dialogue permitted. So they are Muslims, we are something else, and the war goes on. You can't do that. So if you keep all human traditions alive, be a socialist or a capitalist if you want to, in your economics, in your social organizing, add non-violence. And so on. Be a nationalist. Very proud of Indian nationalism, by all means. But add non-violence to it. Do not try to set historical wrongs right. If the ancestors of Muslim minorities did something wrong, that is not your. It is not for you to seek revenge for that. Do not try to put historical wrongs right. You're a new nation. Start from a clean slate. Otherwise, you're being violent. And so on. Religion. If you want to establish an Islamic state somewhere, by all means. But do respect minorities, those that are not Muslims. If you want to start a Hindu state, a Christian state, a Buddhist state, whatever, an atheist state, respect minorities. Allow their truth to be represented in the overall group, not as a concession, but as a matter of honor. So that is, I think, the broad teaching of that. And he's for this reason. He remains difficult to follow. It's not easy to live like him, mind you. It's not easy. And he reduced his wants to such an absurd minimum. He lived really that poor man. But why did he do that? And he was a celibate person. He took the vow of celibacy. It's poor. And we can't want to be like that. But surely if one man could do this so heroically, the rest of us could at least exercise some respect. And the reason there must always be monks and nuns in the world is that otherwise nobody would be restrained at all in their lives. If there are some who can renounce everything The rest of us can surely do with a few things left. So I think this is his role, as a violent, if you like, from a non-violent man, as a violent corrective to the greed that was going to overwhelm us. I think he adopts these lifestyles of extreme self-denial. If he hadn't talked about the village economy in that idealistic, romantic way, there wouldn't even be agriculture today, let alone the village economy. There wouldn't be any peasantry today. The industrialized nations of the world have not really understood the peasant, the person, the family that creates food, the man that honors that. This is a sacred task always. It goes back thousands of years. It has to be respected. It has to be honored. And Gandhi wanted to live like the peasant because he wanted to correct the bias of modern times against agriculture and towards industry merely, which means also then towards war, towards control. That Gandhi also, above all, I think, is a teacher of what I would call symbols. There is a symbolism to everything that he did. Let me give you, you no doubt you know the story, or perhaps you don't, when he came to London in 1931, I think, to attend a conference which the British Empire had organized to discuss constitutional reform in India. He was invited to a tea party by King George V. And he, of course, wore only a sort of loincloth and a sort of cloth over his shoulder. Somebody said, are you wearing enough clothes for the King's party? He said, well, he's wearing enough for both of us. Now, there is humor there, which I think is important. That's something that's meant to be shared. There's enough cloth in the world to go round. If everybody wanted to wear the same amount of clothes, nobody would have enough clothes to wear. So that's the general message there, that there is enough in the world to go round. But the hand-spun cloth that you wear, I sometimes wear hand-spun cloth, not always. He arrives in India wearing he ought to be given some kind of posthumous award by some dressmaker. He persuades Indians, his followers, millions of them, to wear a kind of cap, cloth cap. And let me explain the symbolism of that. That is a cap which he saw prisoners wearing in South Africa. So India is a sort of Indians are prisoners of the British Raj. So he makes them wear a prisoner's cap, so to speak, to remind them that they are prisoners and fighting for freedom. It's an amazing, amazing symbolism. But not only that. In India, if you wear a cap on your head, then various kinds of things become invisible. Hard to tell who is from which caste or from which religion. So he's able to create unity where there was none at the level of symbolism. And also, that is, you have to cover your head in India if you go to a place of worship. So he makes everyone respect the sacred, and so on. In everything, he's one of the early ecologists. No wasting of things. He wouldn't throw away. He must have been amongst the first to write letters on the backs of envelopes, I think, in this century. Things that have become fashionable now, he introduced. Interfaith prayer. These things are now fashionable and possible. They were dangerous then. He did dangerous things, saving things, and often not with success in material terms, but with influence in symbolic terms. That symbolic influence of Gandhi survives. And so I would like to end with reminding you of Gandhi and Charlie Chaplin. Both sort of enter the film period of our century, more or less at the same time. And when I see Gandhi documentary films, or also Hitler and Mussolini, I've seen all these four kinds of film, documentary and film. Hitler and Mussolini march like that in a dangerous way. Huh? It's very comic, but very dangerous. But Gandhi and Charlie Chaplin also walk like that in that fast-forward way of early films, but in a humorous way. And Charlie Chaplin is wearing those unmanageably huge clothes, you see. He's suggesting that all this, you know, he doesn't really fit us, all this arrogance of our identities, of our clothes and of our
and Fab Ego. And Gandhi goes to that other extreme and wears very few clothes. But together, I think, Charlie Chaplin, if Charlie Chaplin is always victorious in the end against all kinds of odds, it's because he has that native simplicity of the soul. And Gandhi is a sort of Charlie Chaplin on the stage of history in this century, I think. Imagine scoring those victories and suffering those defeats, but always, I think, with instruction. So I hope you'll be able to see him as a fellow architect of some kind. Can you speak a little louder? I am actually a little... Yes, the village hut was very important for him, that people should be able to make their own houses, have materials available there, mud houses, thatched houses. He was very concerned about the self-sufficiency of architecture in villages. It should not be necessary for villages to bring costly materials from outside, mass-produced bricks, for instance, or cement or anything like that. And these, of course, are very practical. There are architects in India now who've discovered low-cost housing and building out very, very inexpensive local materials. But they are not yet popular, unfortunately. There are lobbies that prevent this. But Gandhi was amongst the first to recommend that building materials local building materials be used and traditional building skills be employed. He certainly did. That was top of his agenda, self-sufficiency in building. Yes. And in medicine, he was always experimenting with herbs and so on, because that really is a cheap system of medicine, available locally, with local skills, and some way ecologically more appropriate to sicknesses. And education, the teaching in native tongues. But he had the wisdom, I think, not to make a fetish of these things. He tried very hard, and really hasn't succeeded in a big way in persuading. I would love to have seen all government offices in New Delhi to be built out of local materials. This is not the case. Ugly, horrid things. And expensively, unnecessarily expensively made. And not beautiful at all. His own hut where he lived, in his ashram, in his community, very simply built, looked quite attractive. Built, rebuilt again.
Can you think of anything that the British brought to India before independence which was actually good?
Why not? The British brought to India a sense of the enormous wrong that Indians had done to themselves. This was a very good thing. And of the importance of being morally angered about these things. But for this, there would not have been a man like Gandhi, really, speaking about so many matters. Because traditional Indian society had rather neglected the question of human equality.
This is
very tangible. When you live in India, when you say suddenly Gandhi say that this is a blot on Hinduism, untouchability, this is because this was the British often left didn't themselves try to improve these things because they wanted to rule the country. But if you wanted to be free, if you wanted to rule your own country, you couldn't do this without getting rid of some of these horrid things like untouchability and so on, because otherwise it would hardly be morally worth it. I think it's very important. You must understand that when a society has failed to govern itself and another civilization, another race moves in, there is a tremendous loss of self-esteem. And the better the alien system works, the worse the self-esteem gets. And this alien system brings education, brings many opportunities. Now, all these are good things, but this deepens the loss of self-esteem in the people who've lost their freedom. And this is really a good. When I said Gandhi was a friend to him, in many respects, I think the relatively benign rule of the British Indian, I say relatively because it wasn't always benign, did help Indians to look at their own society squarely and try and put things right. But I think what, look, in concrete terms, I do really think that the system of modern education, which has many, many imperfections and defects, and the English language, is a very good thing because it brought Indians together. So many of us learned the English language. We were able to communicate with you directly without the need for translators. And this is a tremendous gain. It's brought millions of people within sort of conversation range of others so that there can be mutual help and learning now. But mistakes were made. I think traditional learning was ignored by the British government in India, often with the very unfortunate agreement of Indian leaders. It should have been possible to keep. Now, the average Indian student in college or school has very little idea of what their own tradition has taught. So this is sad. But we're allowing for that. I think the introduction of modern education and a world language like English, not to mention democratic forms of government, and not to mention cricket. No, I think there's a list of quite concrete things that were done, but more effective, more important even than any one of these concrete things was the general fact of arousal to moral self-questioning about a number of matters.
And this actually didn't exist, or you're suggesting,
No, the vast country, several principalities, an empire, the Mughal Empire in decay. Wonderful things happening in different parts, but not all coming together. Not a process which was creating one people. I do think history has many purposes, and we don't see some of these things until long after an event has taken place. I certainly, while I feel quite opposed to many things during the British presence, I'm on the whole grateful for it. Certainly.
Do you think the Dalai Lama in his Nobel Prize approach towards the Chinese occupation of Tibet has in any way followed Gandhian principles?
I would have thought so, whether it's the Dalai Lama, whether it is Martin Luther King. If Gandhi had not lived, surely if their strategies have some kind of special authority today, it's partly because Gandhi lived. If people are willing to listen to them and talk to them, and it's partly because of Gandhi. If they had been doing it the first time, it would have been much more difficult. Surely. It's hard to know. I think yes. I think he is, in some respects, talking about ecology in a much bigger way than Gandhi did. He did in his own life, but he wants to create a zone in Tibet which is without ecological violation. So that's new, I think. So that the emphasis is certainly bigger. Yes, and he doesn't even want a separate state. He's happy to have a relative kind of autonomy. Incidentally, that's what Gandhi had wanted for a long time, dominion status within the Commonwealth. But this wasn't conceded. So the Dalai Lama has similarities, I think, to Gandhi, but I think he has his own novel teachings and approaches. Yes. But he himself is very happy to acknowledge his debt to Gandhi. Some of you traveled in India? Yeah? It really, on the question of architecture, I do really think that we need to evolve. It's a very great shame that we simply haven't followed the genius of our own traditions or learning. It's very, very great change.
The long buildings in the New Death Valley seems
to be so hideous. Hideous and really unsuited to the climate, to the temperament, everything. Whether it's clothes or... Gandhi was an innovator. I think cotton cloth, the Huntsman, is very practical, very, very useful. And similarly, what we wear, how we live, houses we build, the cities we... I think after Gandhi there simply wasn't a tall enough figure to give direction. And newly independent nations want to be big and want to show off and want that. I think there's a very, very common human tendency to be sort of successor states to the retreating power. So big is beautiful and more is important are the doctrines, and they're both probably false. Yes. Pardon? Well, I was not a very bright 10-year-old grandson when he was killed. I didn't engage him in... I remember him as being very warm, but not but to all children and everyone. And certainly very special and very different. He was and was not like an ascetic. He was, of course, he lived a very austere life, but he was not afraid of people. He lived in the midst of people. He was a politician who was not corrupt, which is very strange. He was a religious person who was not a bigot, extraordinary thing to be. He was an ascetic who was not afraid of women, very rare. And so on. He ate very little, but he had a huge sense of enjoyment of life as a whole. He had a sense of humor. He could laugh at himself. Yes?
Do you think India would be radically different today?
Say that again, please.
Do you think India would be radically different today had Gandhi lived longer?
I think the world would be very different. It's a very important question. I appreciate your asking this. If in 1948, when Gandhi was 78, but a vigorous 78, I do remember that as a child. He was a very athletically strong man at 78 because he'd lived that kind of life. He would have easily had 10 more years of active life. Now, the division of India, very unfortunate. Now, he would have surely healed the bitterness of it, brought the Hindus and the Muslims of the subcontinent together. He had done it before. He would have done it again. But his killing at that point was a great blow. So this tremendous experiment. And if that had happened, so many other things. In 1950, China becomes a republic. If Gandhi had met Mao, they would have shared. Mao was the leader of an Asian country which wanted to experiment with a Western idea, communism. But Gandhi was an Asian leader who wanted to experiment with something else. Together they could have evolved something else. He could have traveled. He could have come to Britain after the war. The wounds of the war, he would have helped to heal throughout Europe. He could have traveled to America after the dropping of the atom bomb. He would have been a tremendous force for peace and for unity and for creativity, I think. I don't think everyone would have accepted his teaching, but he would have exercised a moderating influence, surely. And a very great tragedy, very great loss. If he had been 90 or an unfit or a sick and ailing man, I wouldn't have said these things. Or if his creativity had dried up, that was not the case. He was thinking some of his brightest ideas at the time. And all these half-developed ideas in economics and so on, he would have had time to connect with other thinking in other parts of the world. Or I think not only India, but Asia and perhaps other parts of the world. Africa, much neglected today. Gandhi started his political life in Africa, in South Africa. And he would surely have wanted to go back to South Africa. And what's happening only now would have probably begun to happen 7 years ago, with all kinds of unexpected good effects flowing from that. It's a good question. And a great pity that... people ask me, what would Gandhi do if he were alive today? Well, he'd be very old, for one thing.
125 in October.
Well, thank you very much for truly, I feel honored that students of architecture should want to listen to an Indian philosopher on all these matters. But I wish you great success in adventurous architecture, really. God bless.